The idea is to keep teaching people to carve ice, so I have a constant supply of carvers. And it's already happening. Our network, as far as the number of people ice carving, is growing at a rapid rate.
So your plan is to train people to buy your ice?
Yeah, in so many words. And to create events. The chefs like to compete, and we really do some unique things. The other tools that they use are chisels. They have flats and Vs and gouges. And one of the things that never fails to amaze me is just how creative the chefs are. If they have something that they want to do with ice, they'll shape a tool accordingly and create a handle to go with it and make a tool. He takes each a musical instrument and carves it in ice and sets it up in a manner that they would be on stage. And then he carves a replica of the conductor. They put a baton in his hand, set up speakers and lights, and they play music that you'd hear at the symphony out in a park setting. One of the most difficult things we had to do was to get a liability insurance to cover this. It's a power tool. You have electricity and water. You have a 400-pound block of ice. You have people moving around it. So there's a lot of potential to slip. You know, there's chips that fly off the ice when you carve. The block can fall on you. You can slip while you're working. We had the potential of it being 70 to 80 degrees, and we had to come up with a method to move 120 blocks and construct them in this shape and carve them in less than a 5 to 6 hour time period.
What was the temperature that day?
We lucked out. It was overcast, which is beautiful for us, and the temperature was about 55 degrees.
The arching that Tom's doing is going to be done by eye only, as far as making sure that his right and left side match, that he has the shape lengthwise. There's some dimensions, of course, that you must follow, and we do have tools for checking symmetry, but as far as shaping of the scroll and the top and back of the violin, it is a lot of eye. Many students prefer a darker room because you get more contrast with the light.
So you're constantly holding your work to the light,
right,
looking across it for shadow.
And adjusting your lamps. And yet once, you know, I had the same impression when I first came, it's so dark. But when you've got too much light in your room, you have a very hard time seeing your work. And it's almost annoying. Many times people will leave a very light area and go to a dark one. I prefer the handwork. I think you get a better feel for the instrument. There's so much in just a piece of wood. You get to know that wood, you know, where, what direction it's going, the feel of it. I think you're also closer, since we are building traditional instruments from traditional patterns, you feel like you're producing an instrument that's closer to the old masters.
You've got a template. It's made out of plastic, and you just trace it on there according to which way your grain's going, and you saw it out, and you can just start cutting then with your knife.
How many will you do to practice before you actually put one on your instrument?
As few as possible, hopefully.
What happens if you put one on your instrument that isn't quite right? It's too late to go back, isn't it?
Then you get Mr. Lee to repair it for you.
Yeah. It's repairable?
Some of them, yeah.
Being a dentist, you work with very exacting standards, and this just follows along. So it's a little different medium, different material, but essentially it's the same.
When you tighten the strings for the first time, certain parts of it are kind of adjusting, and you hear all these cracks and creaks, and it's real frightening. I think everybody worries about that with their first one, that the neck is going to snap off, or when you put all the pressure on, it's just going to, you know, come apart. But I don't know of anyone that's happened to. So, but it, you know, it's a fear, sure.
Yeah.
So you can play an instrument and hear maybe the bottom notes have a nice ringing sound. And the upper notes might sound a little nasal. There's your bottom. Compared to. So you can hear a lot more ringing after that bottom string.
These are very subtle differences, and certainly
yes.
If it's not frustrating to you to have to keep going back to the same instrument.
Well, it depends. Because a lot of times you fix one thing and something else happens. And the instrument will change the more it's played or the less it's played. Thank you.
There were no other Dorothys possible. The role, it has about a 2.5 octave range, and it's very active, and she was the only one who made it through the audition. It was not even a question of choosing. She was the only one who could do the role and was also wonderful at it.
We're accepting the fact that white actors could be cast in this, but we know that when a production like 1776 is coming up or something like that, they're not going to consider black actors in some of the lead parts. So I think somebody said it very well. It's like saying, let's integrate the colleges and then start with Howard University and not integrate any other college.
A lot of them were bitter. And instead of going out and seeking other jobs, they decided they're going to hang on this issue and hang on it and hang on it. And personally, once you've made your statement, the whiz is going on. We're doing it tonight, and we're going to do it until April 19th, and nobody's going to stop it. Nobody looked at the positive side of it. This is a milestone in itself. When's the last time you saw 10 blacks on a stage at Marriott Theater?
What's wonderful about this show is that it's about people, and it's about taking off the extra things that make you unreal. And that's actually what non-traditional casting is about. It's about getting rid of the outside superficial things and getting to the real things of the people and the talent.
The interaction suddenly became forced and stilted because we wanted people to see that we were doing an innocuous show out here, that it benefits from being black and white. All of a sudden, rehearsals and even some of the performances were significant and meaningful, and that'll kill a fairy story, you know?
The thing that was important was, how good is this production? I don't care if everybody's pink. Does it work? Do we have fun? Do they sing well? The show turned out cute and kind of fun, with some wonderful special effects and good singing. And after the first 5 minutes, the color controversy sort of faded into the woodwork.
I'm acting just like a baby, but I'm gonna be all right soon as I get home. Soon as I get home.
Let's go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's right. When we make matzah, it cannot take more than 18 minutes from the time we mix the flour and the water until the matzah is already all baked out of the oven. If it takes more than 18 minutes, we may not use that matzah for Passover. Matzah is certainly the symbol of the entire holiday. Those Jews who are observant eat the matzah throughout the entire 8 days of the holiday. And by children seeing how matzah is made, it adds to the significance of the holiday and to the importance and to the meaning of the holiday. In a real Pesach bakery, they would change the tablecloths every 18 minutes because the old flour is no good. It's from the previous 18 minutes, and we don't want that to mix in with the new flour, with the new dough. But they would change the rolling pins, and you have to be above bar and bat mitzvah to bake Pesach matzah. How many of you are bar mitzvah already? Ah, not too many, a few, just a few.
In the bag.
Hi, Bernie. I have special things for Pesach.
I want to see. Plates? What do you need those for? You already got plates.
We need new dishes for Pesach, Bernie. The old dishes have bread on them.
Oh, what else is in there?
I have wine. Special for Pesach.
Who drinks wine?
Everybody does at the Seder.
Shana haba, Yerushalayim hanuya. Shana haba, Yerushalayim hanuya. Shana Hapa, Yerushalayim, Shana Hapa, Yerushalayim, Hatuya, Shana Hapa, Yerushalayim, Shana Hapa, Yerushalayim, Hatuya. Shana haba Yerushalayim hatuya. Shana haba Yerushalayim hatuya. Shana haba Yerushalayim. Shana haba Yerushalayim hatuya. Shana haba Yerushalayim. Shana haba Yerushalayim.
Is this the second marriage for both of you?
Yes.
So we should know better.
Would you otherwise have had a family wedding or some other, or did you want to get married in a judge's chambers anyway?
What's the highest grade you want in school? Because you quit.
Right.
I don't know.
Okay, I went to junior. That's 11.
You went 3.
11.
Yeah, 11.
You almost had me again.
Divorce. You got your divorce papers? Mm-hmm. But you otherwise, you wanted a small wedding like this, you wouldn't have...
Yeah, it might have been a church, but nothing big, you know, mm-hmm. just same thing, with just maybe one or two people. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want nothing big.
So you don't feel like they had, you changed your plans very much because of this test?
No, just 90 miles.
Twice.
Okay.
My second marriage.
Are you drive that much when you go shopping?
Well, you're from Summit. That's,
You ever hear of Argo Corn Products?
Yeah, I've been there, actually, to the Argo office.
You was in
so
Summit,
then. Yeah.
Argo Summit.
Your family pretty far.
No, we went.
No, you just lived there, right?
Right.
You worked there. And what is it about the test, though? I mean, I'm trying to just figure out. It's not just the money. It's just the idea of taking it.
Right. That should be a personal choice, you know? I believe, I know she's healthy, you know? If I thought otherwise, I wouldn't be marrying her. It's that simple. And she feels the same way about me. That's it.
So there's something about the state getting involved that you don't like?
Yeah, that's like, why don't they tell me what kind of gum to chew? That's it.
Okay.
There's the knife.
Oh. Tell me what kind of car to drive. You're going to want some money for yourself. Or is that what you're waiting for?
$50.
Is it all done?
Sure. You had it, fella.
Your name, please?
Jim Sauder.
Sowder. Okay. And your bride, your name, please?
Anna. Kal-El.
K-A-L-A-L. Do you feel the same way about the test?
Yes.
Why is it that you didn't want to take it?
I don't know. I just think it's wrong. I don't think it should be mandatory where you have to take it.
How do you feel about having to come all the way up here to get married because of that?
No, we were going to go somewhere anyhow because we don't want my family to know nothing. Be perfectly honest. My family's one, if you get married, you got to have something big, you know? And we don't want nothing big, so we're going away to do it.
This is a secret of a place.
Yes, nobody knows.
You're both from Summit?
Mm-hmm.
You'll get married next Saturday?
This Saturday, we're hoping.
Okay. Good luck. I wonder, why did you come up here to get your license?
It's my friend's idea, though. My friend's idea told me that it's easier and much AIDS test and, you know.
Why didn't you want to take the AIDS test?
It's not really that we don't want it to take, but maybe it's because of my friend's experience, you know, getting married here much easier. That's my basis there.
But your friend got married here already?
Yeah.
And they told you how easy
right,
it was?
Right.
Okay, how soon do you plan to get married?
Huh?
To get married? What day?
Today.
But you won't do the wedding today. You're getting your license today?
Yeah, license.
And so you'll come back for
right,
a wedding
right.
later. Did you want to have a wedding in the judge's chambers, or had you thought about doing a church wedding or something different?
Yeah,
I thought about that, but it's too expensive.
Okay, and your names, please? I just wanted to ask you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I understand. Can you call this number? Sure. I'm trying to think, there have been so many different things. At one point I said, you've heard of voodoo economics, this is...
So basically what I've already learned is that it has succeeded in driving a lot of couples out of the state to get married.
Yes.
But from a medical perspective, has it done any good?
Well, I would be the first to say there have been some side benefits to this that are desirable. One certainly is that physicians have been forced to learn themselves about the HIV antibody test, have been forced to do some of the counseling and see how difficult it is and what skills it requires. And I think among heterosexually active people, there's been more discussion about HIV and HIV antibody testing. And that is all a reasonable benefit. Unfortunately, the answer still is, medically, it's been proven to be a failure. The amount of testing that we've done, 25,000 tests to identify 6 people total positive, is an extraordinary waste of time and energy and resources. What you don't see reflected in that figure of 6 individuals is the number of people with falsely negative tests. You don't see the people who have the false positive and equivocal Western blot tests. I know of at least 2 such individuals in Illinois where the outcome of the Western blot testing was equivocal. They were told they had to be tested again in another 3 months, and in the meantime they should behave as though they were positive, that they couldn't be definitively told that they were or were not infected. And the number of people in that condition is probably going to equal the number of people we identify who are truly infected, perhaps as many as 100. Unfortunately, we've just seen a number of measures to repeal this bill fail. And what's been said is, well, we need a full year to see how much time it'll take.
Go ahead.
It was on the repeal measures.
So is it the idea that you're not testing the right population?
That's exactly the right idea, and also that this test is expensive, particularly when you do confirmatory testing. The real expense of AIDS prevention is the counseling. And here's a measure that's gotten us to counsel 25,000 individuals who we believe to be at very low risk, where we know that some 50 to 60,000 people carry the virus in Illinois. Another 500,000 are at significant risk, are homosexually active men or actively using intravenous drugs, or are their immediate heterosexual partners. Those are the people we would like to get that counseling to most urgently, and yet here we are testing this other group of people. The other major adverse result of this, I think, that's also been reported is that no public agency is providing this testing free of charge. That means that poor people essentially are being discriminated against, and there's a disincentive if you're poor to getting married. It costs $100 to $200 now per couple to go through the whole testing and counseling process, including a physician visit. And what's happening is what you said. People are going to Milwaukee and across the state lines in Indiana and Iowa. Really, I think the important thing is this is like voodoo public health. It's creating the impression that something is being done. It's not costing the state general revenues anything, but it certainly is costing taxpayers. The estimates now are that $350,000 to $400,000 have been spent with this practice. The kinds of things that could be done with that money without this process would include getting specific counseling and testing to people at the highest risk, making condoms widely available through various model intervention programs, trying to reach the 80,000 intravenous drug users in our state for whom there are only 10% of treatment slots available. I think that's the greatest failure of the General Assembly, has been to commit the resources needed for general AIDS education and AIDS education for specific groups at risk, as well as to provide compassionate services for people who are affected. The issue of intravenous drug use in the state of Illinois has been uniformly ignored, partly because this is a group without any articulate spokespeople, partly because many people are cynical about the ability of these individuals to stop using drugs, although the medical literature does show that you can get a quarter to a half of people who use drugs regularly off of their medications with an intervention. It costs money, but in fact that's another one of the real prices of AIDS control in the state of Illinois, and certainly not this what I think is just a crazy piece of legislation, the premarital testing. It's been said, well, give it a year and we'll see what happens. How much more money do we have to spend on this before we decide? Now we have 25,000 people tested and 6 positive. If we go to 100,000, so we'll have 24 positive, or 200,000. That's how many people got married in Illinois last year, and that'll give us twice as many, 48 people positive. You just do not have a compelling argument that this is effective use of these precious public health resources. I'm very sympathetic to those people who want to make sure that women understand that AIDS is an issue for them, that heterosexuals appreciate that they're at some risk if they're having multiple casual partners. And marriage is a reasonable opportunity to make that point. We, the Illinois AIDS Council, recommended that a pamphlet be available in all clerks' offices that describes the simple information about AIDS and, if necessary, provides further numbers for counseling and testing sites so individuals could go do that on their own. It simply is not a reasonable practice in this very low incidence population to mandatorily test everybody. It sends the wrong message. It makes it appear that we're doing something when, in fact, many, many other areas of serious need in the state of Illinois are going ignored.
Now, the people who are avoiding the test say a few things. They say that it's expensive, which you seem to corroborate. Do you said 100 to 200 per couple. Do you know what that's a good range?
Mm-hmm.
And then also they say they're worried about it may show the wrong information and then they'll be no further ahead and could be hassled. Do you think that is also true, you said?
Well, fortunately, the number of people with false positive or equivocal outcomes is extremely small. It's actually as small as the number of positives that we'll find. And with additional testing, in most instances, an individual can determine positively they are or they are not infected. There still will be a small percentage who are indeterminate. No, in general, this is not a technical flaw of the test, and that's very important. It's not as though when we have our next generation or the generation after that, we'll be able to eliminate this minor imprecision in an otherwise sound public health policy. That's not the problem. With any test, no matter how good it is, and the HIV antibody test is a very accurate and sensitive test, no matter how good it is, in a low incidence population, the predictive value of the test, that is, when you have a positive, how certain can you be that it means it's a true positive? It depends on the incidence in the population. In a low incidence, there still will be a larger number of falsely positive tests than truly positive. There'll have to be additional confirmatory testing. The problem here really is this an effective use of public health funds and resources? And I would say of taxpayers' money, because indeed it is taxpayers who are bearing this burden. I think you do hear reasons from couples getting married that don't quite ring true. They're afraid of the issue and they don't want to talk about it, and they'd rather go across state lines so they don't have to confront it. That obviously is something that's against everybody's interest, including their own. It's clear that we want there to be a higher level of basic AIDS information understanding. And an example of that, I think, is the mailing that went out to every household in the country just recently. But this measure will not accomplish that goal in a substantive and an appropriate way. We can be much better with targeted voluntary testing and counseling and getting the information where people most at risk are. Again, in the issue of intravenous drug users, we need street-based educators, as well as a vast increase in the number of treatment slots. I think it's encouraging that the President's Commission made those statements long ago in their preliminary report, and I think it's clear that that's a direction that we will begin to move in here in Illinois.
Who is the chief supporter of this?
Some disaccreditation and disbelief, mistrust of public health authorities. The ideas that I'm describing here are not only my own and shared by all of the AIDS experts in Chicago and in Illinois, but the world over. I think there's a consensus that this is ill-advised public health policy. And yet we see elected officials embarking on this kind of thing. Well, at least here in Illinois and in Louisiana, these laws have been passed. It's important to say on the subject of legislation in Illinois, some of the most progressive measures in the country passed last year as well. Mandatory AIDS education, grades 6 through 12, a very comprehensive AIDS Confidentiality Act that mandated there must be written informed consent and counseling with every test performed in Illinois. And yet, on the other hand, there were some exclusions added to that bill. Insurers and HMOs were allowed to test people with renewed or new insurance policies without informing individuals, without doing that counseling, rather. And I think that just leads to a whole nother issue, is the problem of AIDS cost and how will we bear the cost for the health care in the future. That's a terrible problem here in Illinois, as it is nationwide. I don't think that any state has exactly come up with a complete answer. We need a national solution for that problem, whether it be national health insurance or some other form of guaranteed health coverage for these individuals.
Louisiana passed theirs.
Louisiana state show. The private.
My first question is, how did you feel about having to take the test?
Well, I really wasn't too keen on it. It was just the law, so that's why I took it. Otherwise, if I had a choice, I wouldn't have taken the test. Not really, because it's not a foolproof thing. And it only detects the people who have those AIDS symptoms at the time. But if it's in dormancy or anything, it wouldn't prove anything, and the AIDS symptoms might appear the day after or something like that. So to me, it's kind of foolish.
Some people who decided not to take the test found it kind of insulting. Was that something that crossed your mind?
No, it's never crossed my mind.
So you didn't mind taking it?
No, I didn't mind taking it. It's just another extra vial of blood.
What procedure did you have to go through? Did you have trouble finding a doctor? Did your regular doctor do it? Did it take a long time?
Well, I went to my regular doctor, but he told me it was about $47 with the lab that they work with, so he told me I should go to the county health department, Lake County, and I went there, and it was $25 there.
Oh, that's very low. Some people said they're paying up to $100. And then did it take a long time to get the results?
Approximately a week. Mm-hmm. Approximately a week.
So what's the problem? You say you had a trouble difference between where you took it and where your fiancé
right.
took it?
My fiancé had her blood test taken here in Chicago, and it was only $15. And they gave her the results in a week, and I didn't have to be there. And she had to be in Waukegan with me when I obtained my results, because they told me that's the law. So I thought there was inconsistency there.
So that if you had AIDS, she would have been the first to know.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Did you mind that?
Not really.
You were
at
worried.
This point, that was the last thing on my mind.
Okay. How much did she pay for hers? Do you know?
$15.
$15 for hers?
Right.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. You're all set. Otherwise, we have nothing to do but talk to me now. Right? Can we just stand back a little
bit?
Did you
talk to my mother?
No.
What's going to be so? I thought it's in there. I wanted to ask you about the AIDS test. How did you feel about having to take that before you could get your license?
I don't think it was fair. For one thing, I know that I don't have AIDS, and for me to spend that much money and not to have it, and I think it was a waste of time and money.
What about the other half of it, the idea that, you know, you've led a clean life and you had no contact with anyone who could have had AIDS and then still had to take the test? Did that concept bother you?
Yeah. And, well, like I said before, I had to pay for it. And I think it's a good idea, you know, for those who, you know, are unsure of their partner, or if their partner has been fooling around on them, they know for sure. And they know that they can lead a normal life and have normal children.
So you think maybe if it was an optional test, you would like that as a law better?
Well, yeah. And then if you didn't have it, maybe a reimbursement or something. I don't know.
Where did you take yours, and how was the procedure? Did it take a long time to get the results? What did it cost?
Well, I went to my HMO doctor.
I'm so worried about this echo. I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you mind if we step either just out or in?
I prefer.
You're trying to hide, like, in here to
yeah,
stay here?
Yeah.
All right. We won't worry about it.
I forgot the question. What was the question?
Right, you went to
my HMO doctor, and the test only cost $15. And they took it on a Thursday, and they came back on a Tuesday. So they were quick.
So it wasn't too much trouble, really?
No. It's just that my fiancé I had to go down and get his results. I had to know his results, and he didn't have to come down to mine. And basically, maybe it's my my doctor. He said that both tests were negative, and he felt that there was no danger and no worry for my fiancé to come in. So there was one good pro about that.
Uh-huh. And spell your last name for me. Pronounce it, please.
My married name, or?
Well, that gets
my name now.
No, it's not for long, is it? You'd be taking Steve's name. I wasn't sure.
My name is Jeanette Rivera, R-I-V-E-R-A, mm-hmm. and my married name will be Pantoja, P-A-N-T-O-J-A.
Okay. And by the time this airs, that's where you'll be. Because you know what's funny?
These guys are offering me $900 a week plus commission from the cover charge. And the accompanist told Joe, he said, Joe, you're doing here good at the Green Mill. Let's stay here. And Joe said, no, I'm going to make a change. In the meantime, he told Al Cohen, he said, Al, Joe Lewis told Al, Al, my contract is up, coming up. I don't want to renew it. And Al Cohen said, what do you mean you don't want to renew your contract? I brought you up from nothing. You were just a little shrimp working in a little place on the south side. I brought you over here to the Green Mill. You're a big star. Now you want to leave me. And Joe said, well, I'm sorry, but I got this new offer. So Al Cohen decided, I got to do something to keep them guy here. So he gets a hold of Jack McGurn. And Jack McGurn was Al Capone's top hitman, a good-looking Italian guy. In fact, I met him in 1936 when I worked at the Brass Rail before he got killed. And Al Cohen says to Jack, he said, Jack, Joe Lewis wants to leave me. I tell you what, I'll give you half interest in the Green Mill if you get Joe to stay here, because he's our drawing card. Without him, I'm lost. And Jack McGurn says to Al, don't worry about it. I'll talk to Joe. So Jack McGurn meets Joe. And he said, Joe, I hear you're leaving the Green Mill. And Joe says, yes, it's true. He says, you're going to be sorry. You'll never live to open up at the new rendezvous. He said, why don't you stay at the Green Mill? We need you. I'm the owner there. What do you mean you're the owner? Well, I bought half interest in a place. He says, you better not leave the Green Mill. I'm warning you. And Joe tells his accompanist, he says, you know, Jack McGurn warned me about leaving the Green Mill. And now the accompanist says, Joe, don't leave. So Joe said, hell, I'm not afraid of anybody. I'm going to leave. So in the meantime, Joe knew a police captain at town hall. And he tells his police captain what Jack McGurn's threatened him. And the police captain says, I tell you what, Joe, you do as you think is best. But I'll tell you what, I'll give you a bodyguard. You're living at the Commodore Hotel. I'll put a bodyguard next to your room. Anybody threatens you or tries to harm you, just knock on the door. But one thing, don't answer that door when somebody knocks unless you notify the bodyguard that somebody's knocking at your door. Because myself, I'm a police captain, but what can I do? So Joe leaves the Green Mill, opened up the new rendezvous, I think the last week in October. The Green Mill is three people in the whole place. Everybody's at the new rendezvous because Joe Lewis had built up such a big following wherever he was going to go. They all went to. And like Joe Lewis told Jack, he said, Jack, you're threatening me. I'll tell you what I'll do. On my opening night at the new rendezvous, I'll reserve a table right in front of the bandstand, and anything you have on that night is on me. And opening night comes, table is there, set up, champagne. Jack McGurn doesn't show up. So 2 weeks go by, and Joe is figuring out, no, but nothing's gonna happen to me. And he goes out drinking after he gets through with his show at the new rendezvous. Goes to his hotel, he's drunk. Goes to sleep. At 10 o'clock in the morning, somebody knocks on his door. And he's half drunk and not aware of what he should have done. Should have notified the man next door, the bodyguard, that somebody was at the door. In the meantime, the bodyguard had gone out to get something to eat. When Joe opens the door, three guys walk in, and they just beat the living hell out of Joe. They fractured his jaw, they cut him from ear to ear, blackened his eyes, and oh, just give him a terrible, terrible beating. They took the gun butts and just fractured his skull. And Joe, when they leave, Joe crawls into the hallway, calls for help, and nobody hears. Finally, one of the other guests is coming in, and he sees this guy laying there, blood all coming out of his face. He runs downstairs, notifies the clerk. The clerk called the police, the ambulance. They take Joe to the hospital. And he was in the hospital for about 9 months. In the meantime, a Catholic priest had liked Joe. And he's the one that when Joe come to his out of coma, he kind of nursed Joe back to health because Joe was figured he wasn't going to live. He was still beating up so badly. So when Joe gets out of the hospital, it took him about 2.5 years to articulate. He couldn't articulate. He couldn't remember anything, and he was just like a shell of his old self. So in the meantime, when Al Capone found out what happened, he goes to the hospital and he tells Joe, "Joe, why didn't you tell me these guys were threatening you? I'd have fixed everything up." And to Joe's dying day, he regrets that he never told Al Capone what happened. Anyway, in 1930, Joe comes back here to the Green Mill. He opens up here, but he was a big flop because the people expected him to be like his old self, but he couldn't communicate with the customers. He couldn't sing, he couldn't dance. And he was such a good entertainer that, like I said, he could the only one that made Al Capone laugh. Anyway, when he starts back over here, he just didn't do any good. Al Capone found out about it. Al Capone gives Joe $10,000 to help him out. Then, a week later, he gives Joe $50,000. He says, "Joe, you and I are partners. He says, you belong to me. But any money you make, that's yours. But I'm just giving you this is because you've been such a good entertainer and I liked you, and this is it." Anyway, when Joe left here in 1930, he went to New York. He became a big star. He was one of the finest and the best nightclub comedian of all time. He played all the big places from the coast, from New York to California. But when he was on Jack Parr's show, he never was a good nightclub comedian, I mean a TV comedian, because his jokes were mostly about tavern, about booze, broads, booze, broads, and betting. And his favorite expression, his expression was when he was on the stage was post time. And Joe, he loved to gamble. And his manager took so much money out of his salary each week. And he told me to tell you about Al Capone. When he come here to the Green Mill, there was an orchestra leader by the name of Jules Stein. Jules Stein, he's still living. He's something 80-something, about 85 years old, I think. In fact, 2 years ago, the CBS had a big special for him because he was a producer of a lot of Broadway shows. When he come to the Green Mill, when Jules Stein see him walk in, Al Capone's favorite song was Rhapsody in Blue. And right away, Jules Stein would start playing Rhapsody in Blue. Anyway, one little incident I'm going to tell you about Al Capone and Joe Louis. When they had a fight at the Soldiers Field, Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney, the night before the fight, Al Capone threw a big party at his place at the Lexington Hotel. All your senators, your big shots, politicians. In fact, Al Capone, he used to make his income in Chicago was $100 million a year. But out of the $100 million, he had to pay $10 million for graft. He controlled every brothel, every bookie, every dry cleaning place. Everybody was paying tribute to him. Anyway, this party, he had the place was packed, all big shots, everybody. And the deal was, Al Capone told Jules Stein, he said, "Jules, tonight, when the people are here, I want you to do me one favor. When you play my song, Rhapsody in Blue, let me get on this front of the bandstand and direct the band." And Jules Stein, "Oh, sure, Mr. Capone, anything you want." So Al Capone, they had a party. Jules Stein started playing it. Al Capone gets up there, leads the band, and you know, he made a mess, but the musicians went with him. And he gave Jules Stein $500, and he gave every member of the band a year's supply of free beer. And the party was a success, and then there was the fights. But Al Capone, he loved this comedian so much that he'd do anything in the world for him. And Jack McGurn beat up Joe Louis, this Al Cohen decided, "Well, I got to do something with the Green Mill. What can I do to get the business back?" The new rendezvous is nobody's going there because the entertainer is gone. Joe Louis is in the hospital. So he went to New York. And there was a woman, hostess. She was like Pearl Mester was. Her name was Tex Guinan. She managed about three places in New York. And everybody built up a fan by the door. And her favorite expression was, "Come on in, suckers. Hello, suckers." And she built up a big following. In fact, the Green Mill, during Prohibition, there was only about five places where the rich people would go to. This was the Green Mill, was not a speakeasy, it was a nightclub. And during Prohibition, they charged you $10 per person cover charge. Everyone had to be in an evening dress, a man had to be in a tuxedo. And when you walked in here, they served you food and you seen the show, but the drinks, you had to bring your own. And people at that time had flasks, and they had canes that had a little cork on the end, and they had liquor, and you ordered a setup, and they'd pour a little liquor in each glass. And you drink that way. Tex Guinan built up a big following in here. But at that time, the revenue agents would come in every now and then and raid the place. And they'd come in, go to a table, pick up a glass, there's liquor in there. And they'd say, Tex, come over here. What kind of place are you running? The people over here got liquor in their drinks. Well, she said, I can't help it. They come in here, they bring, we set up certain setups, but they have their own liquor. But at that time, they knew you real well, they had liquor, legitimate liquor, hitting under the back of the place over there, and they'd serve you liquor in the coffee cups. So they'd arrest Tex Guinan. And every time she was arrested, she demanded to be handcuffed. They put handcuffs on her, take her to the station, book her, and when the policeman would take the handcuffs off, she'd say to the policeman, here, here's $20. Give me those handcuffs. And she was arrested so many times. When she appeared before the judge, she had all these handcuffs on each arm, and she'd shake them in front of the judge, and the judge would just laugh and say, Tex, go on home. Go on home. We don't need you here. And she was living somewhere on Dearborn and near Astor, one of those streets near Dearborn Division, and she developed amoebic dysentery. And they couldn't understand where this amoebic dysentery was, and she died. She took a short time and she died. And some way, after they performed, before he owned the little island in Florida, he'd rent this little kind of like a villa on this island, and he'd go there and spend the winter there. And he rented this from this couple that owned that place, and they didn't know who it was. So somebody told him, you rented their place to Al Capone.
And McGurn once?
Jack McGurn, yeah, at the Brass Rail. And the first dollar tip